I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
Leinster could offer me $5 million a year, I wouldn't go.
It is Johnny Law!
Rugby Weekly.
Little reverse pass, and
magic!
Hello everybody and welcome to your Wednesday episode of Rugby Weekly Extra. Hope you're having a smashing week so far. We are going to chat about Leinster's two big recruitments, one of them massive, the arrival of Jordy Barrett, which we'd kind of signposted on Monday's pod and spoke about in a little bit of detail when it was just a rumour, and then Leinster go and blow away the entire rugby world with that announcement a couple of days ago. Plus, they've added Tyler Blaendahl to their coaching staff as well, replacing Andrew Goodman running their attack for next season. So a nice Kiwi flair to Leinster next year to add to Orge Snyman, and their fans are buzzing. Fans of other provinces, probably not so much, actually. We'll get into all of that with Murray Kinsler. Firstly, Murray, great to see you. How are you doing?
Good, Gav. Looking forward to this chat. It's been a very interesting few days. Obviously, the La Rochelle-Leinster match, it already seems a little bit a while ago because of what's happened, the stuff that you mentioned. So we've plenty to sink our teeth into today.
Yeah, we are going to be running over the game as well with a tooth comb because we're joined once more by former Leinster and Ireland hooker James Tracy. James, how are you getting on?
Good, yeah. It's been a better week than the last couple of years post La Rochelle fixtures, so I'm lapping it in.
Were you expecting the Jordy recruitment? Did you catch wind of it at all in advance of it?
Nothing, no. To be honest, just like the Snyman one, I think it was a reaction signing rather than one that makes sense in terms of filling a void. When a player like Stack becomes available and if you're able to squeeze them in, then it makes no sense to pass up the opportunity. So I can see why they did it, but like from the point of view of, you know, we need a 12/15 to come in for 6 months, you know, it's not something you'd factor into your plan at the start of the year or your 5-year plan. So it's definitely just an opportunistic move, but an interesting one.
As a former Leinster player, as a Leinster fan, did you still get that little bit of a buzz when you saw, though, that it was Jordy Barrett who's going to be wearing your old jersey for 6 months next year?
Yeah, a little bit. Probably not as much as maybe some people, but purely on the basis that it's kind of like, well, who's going to lose out for him in big games? And maybe that's a downfall of my perspective, where I've you know, pals with a good few of the lads who will be losing out on that. So, yeah, and then, you know, you could also have the tinfoil hat on and look at the spin of you know, a New Zealander coming in. He's going to get a flavour of how the Ireland team ticks, as well as an idea of the mindset of the South African defensive system with Nienaber. So a great move from the spy point of view, but I'll take the tinfoil hat off for right now and I'll focus on the positives. It's an amazing opportunity for younger guys than him to learn his mindset, how he approaches games, what he does off the field as well as on the field, and how he looks at different opportunities and practices different skills that maybe we don't. I think the last fresh kind of look from New Zealand we would have had would have been James Lowe, in terms of something so different than what we were used to, and his perspective on counter-attack and different ways of passing the ball that we just never... it was just not part of our DNA. So it'll be interesting what you can learn from that point of view.
It's interesting how James sees it as a potential recon mission, Murray, because a friend of mine, Oisin Kelly, made that exact point to me on Twitter this morning. Anyone thinking Jordy Barrett is being a bit clever, playing with most of Ireland's squad for 6 months, just 2 years out from a World Cup, isn't a bad way to become familiar with them. Honestly, I thought that was an insane theory until I heard James started speaking there.
The spy angle is huge. It just seems like every move now, you're kind of thinking, what's the actual motive behind this? Why is Nienaber here for 2 years before he goes back and wins another World Cup and they beat Ireland or whatever? Yeah, it's impossible not to have that little thought in your mind. But it is interesting just how kind of pointed it is that Jordy Barrett and Scott Robertson was talking about how much he's going to get from the experience. Like, yeah, he'll understand more what Ireland do, but he'll also learn from a lot of really good things that this system has. Loads of the Irish internationals, obviously, in Leinster. He is going to work with an excellent coach. Like, he could have gone to Japan and made a lot more money. He's going to get a lot of money from Leinster, of course he is. He's going to be really well paid for a short stint, but he could have gone to Toyota or Verblitz in Japan and earned more and had a handy feed up 6 months where he just probably got a bit of a rest, realistically. Like, the Japanese league is improving, but it's not at the level of Champions Cup, URC. But and he's kind of booked the trend in that regard. That seems to be what the All Blacks are doing. Go to Japan for their sabbatical and get that kind of almost recuperation and play with a kind of more open, less physical style of rugby. But yeah, fair play to him. He wants to come and play at the highest level with some of the best players in the world and with some of the best coaches in the world. And it probably helps that his current Hurricanes attack coach, Tyler Blaindell, is going as well. So there's a familiarity there. But I imagine he'll get a lot out of it. And he's already, like, he is one of the best players in the world. He's 27. He's in his absolute prime. This is not a player coming over in the twilight of their career to get a nice earner. And I know some players have come to Irish rugby in their 30s and done a really brilliant job and been big influences. But he's right at the peak of his game at the moment. And still, he thinks this is an opportunity to genuinely get a lot out of his 6 month break from Kiwi rugby.
Murray's obviously been playing a lot of his rugby for the All Blacks at 12 and similar for the Hurricanes. I was on this radio show in New Zealand last night just talking about the move, and like, they still very much see him as a utility back. It's almost as though they haven't yet settled on the fact that he's an inside centre, as he would probably see it at the moment. And obviously, he, even depending on sort of match circumstances, he can fill in at other positions as well. But it's your understanding that Leinster will have a full palette here in terms of the position in which they use him, that there won't be kind of restrictions on that front, as may sometimes be the case with an NIQ signing?
That's my understanding of it. They can play him wherever and how often they want, which is different to the Orji Snyman conditions. Like, when the IRFU signed off on that one, they put, as far as I understand, pretty strict conditions. Like, I think he won't be able to start certain games even, just to make sure that Joe McCarthy and James Ryan are getting all their minutes. This one seems to be a little bit different. And I mean, when you try and write out the back line now for next season when he's there, you're thinking, where does he actually fit? Because Robbie Henshaw, Gary Ringrose are already world class, and Hugo Keenan at 15 is world class, and there's two best positions. He has played on the wing for New Zealand actually a few times, so maybe something different like that, but I'm sure he'll want to play 12 or 15. And as we saw recently, there's always injuries. Like, the Leinster squad, when you look at it, the depth is really kind of stacked in the forwards as well. So when you look at their squad list, it's an array of quality in the back line, obviously, but not quite as many options in the senior squad. There's always academy guys who step up. So I'm sure Leo Cullen, he always points it out, there's always injuries. You know, you think, how can they juggle all these back rows? But a couple of them are always injured. But it might be a serious headache if that's not the case in the back line. And it'll be intriguing to see exactly where he slots in on the big match days.
How enticing a prospect would it be to see him line out alongside Gary Ringrose, for example, in midfield, James? Or where would you see Jordy Barrett fitting into this Leinster team if it was a European knockout game in which he was going to start?
So, yeah, I think it is going to come down to form. It's going to, not his form now, because I feel like he's been very consistent over the last kind of 5 years, but it's going to come down to the form of whether it's centre, wing. I think unless Hugo Keenan's injured, he's not going to be starting there. But yeah, it's just, again, this is why when I heard it, I wasn't as excited. So it's kind of like, you know, it doesn't make complete sense, the signing, from Leinster's point of view. You have like Osborne, who's come through on the weekend, like he's like had the, you know, amazing 24 hours, and then boom, like, all right, well, can pretty much write off the second half of next year in terms of getting a big opportunity in European games. I'm sure Ronan Keller won't be too happy to see the sight of him coming in after the World Cup. But listen, like, he will obviously start. I don't think you'll be bringing him in off the bench. I just can't see where yet. because you're having to drop an Irish international starter for him, and someone who's had the Leinster jersey probably for the last 4 or 5 years and played really well. Like, the only argument you could make is winger opposite to James Lowe has chopped and changed more than any other position in that back line. And that's probably the only area where I'd happily concede. But, you know, that's probably his weakest position out of all his positions that he plays. So, yeah, it's an interesting one to see how it unfolds, but not like as excited as maybe other people would be about it, not because of who he is and how good a player he is, because he's amazing, but just the quality of Irish player that we're going to have to drop for him is what kind of sours it for me.
If you're trying to put yourself into Leo Cullen and Jack Niabra's heads when they're actually... When it comes onto their desk with Guy Easterby and all, and they're talking this through, and they think they're probably having this chat like, where does he actually slot in? And they probably just come to the realization that you can never have enough world class players, you can never have too many. And probably Nienaber has experiences with that, I guess, with the Springboks. Like, at times you've been thinking, who the hell are they going to select? Even in Chasing the Sun, they talked about chopping and changing, and it keeps people guessing, and that's a strength to it. And there's no doubt that he makes the 23 stronger. And yeah, it does. Like I said on Monday, Gav, like, Jamie Osborne really is exploding, and I really hope he continues to get those opportunities. But from Leinster's point of view, when they're assessing this and they have the scope in their budget and they have the sign off to sign a player to, I suppose, directly replace Charlie Nattai, then for Leo Cullen and Jack Niabra, who want to just win trophies and have had the frustration in the last couple of years, they're thinking, we got to go for this one.
It always makes sense for any team to add a player of Jordy Barrett's caliber to their squad. You can even figure out where he plays later. Just to have him available to you for 6 months, given his quality, strengthens your 23, strengthens your entire building, really, Mer, as you say. I guess the way fans, at least, of other provinces would view it, it's a little bit what James is saying. It is a luxury signing. It's a signing that they don't actually need right now. They are very strong to begin with. You have Jamie Osborne just about to embark upon what we hope will be a long test career, not to mind a great career for Leinster. And then they would make the case that their provinces at the moment don't have a pot to piss in. We're going to talk about central contracts in a while, which affects all of that. But maybe just from an optical point of view, would you understand where some of those fans are coming from in terms of their perception that Leinster are just given free rein to strengthen, like, to an unlimited degree while they're actually having their budgets squeezed for next season? It's actually harder for them to strengthen. A couple of them are probably going to look a little bit weaker this time next season.
Yeah, I get that sense of injustice. It definitely is strong, and it must be frustrating. And there's probably two issues there. From Leinster's point of view, like, why would they worry about that? They've got to do what they've got to do. And as I said, they had the scope, they had the sign-off. They would rightly point out that they produced the massive bulk of players for the national team, and even guys who aren't starting for them are in the national squad on a regular basis. And they provide players for the other provinces, like, who are dotted around the country, and indeed some guys who are important figures in the other provinces. So that's one side of it. From the union point of view, I guess they also look at it in that way, in terms of, you know, Leinster are delivering all these players. If they want three NIQs on top of that, and they haven't won a trophy for the last couple of years, so why should we prevent them from strengthening? It's impossible to detangle the issues, really, but I guess they have to view them, the provinces, in different ways. Like, and if you think about it, like, other provinces have signed big players. You think of Munster. I think this is the biggest signing since Munster signed D'Alende and Snyman in the same summer. You know, that was huge. And it was a different model. They had to go and find their own private investment. It wasn't like they had scope in their budget because they had central contracts. It was different. But I think the RFU were happy for that to go ahead, because it was clear that those guys were on the same level as Barrett is now, and that world-class players can really supplement and complement what you already have in your system. But yeah, I think the circumstances, not just this signing, but what's happening with the central contracts as well, it's leading to a lot of frustration around the country, and I do get that. Yeah.
Yeah. So Leinster announced this on the back of Dan Sheehan signing a central contract, which brought them to 9, I think, for central contracts. And it looks like Jameson Gibson-Park, as would be deserved, is going to get one as well, which would take them to 10. At the moment, the other three provinces have one each, because you've had Conor Murray and Peter Romani come off them for Munster. You'd imagine Connacht would go up to 2 with Mac Hansen before long, and there are obviously opportunities there, but you could almost see a situation where Ulster wind up with none in the not-too-distant future. I know we're going to chat about this with James as well, Murr, but I think the Irish Times reported this morning that the IRFU are going to look at the central contract system before David Nusafora provides this handover to David Humphreys as well. Are there ways in which you would expect it to change in the short-term future, or what's your perception of that situation for the moment?
Well, the fact that lads are still literally in the last couple of months signing them would suggest not in the immediate short term, and you've seen Caelan Darris go on to a kind of longer term one, so I doubt they'll rip the system up straight away, but it's definitely one that I would imagine is discussed in the union a fair bit, or should be, because it's, and as I said on Monday, it's actually working for them well at the moment. The RFU must be happy with the job they're doing. Like, I know they get criticism all the time, but their national team is one of the best in the world at the moment, and that's how they run the whole system, is to feed that team, because that team creates all the income, that nearly all the income, a massive majority of it, that drives the game. But there's more to the game in Ireland than just that, and the provincial history and that side of the game is really important. And as we're seeing now, there is a very parochial element to it still, and there is very strong opposing views in different corners of the country. So yeah, if it's being reviewed, that's probably good. Whether it changes quickly, I doubt it, because I think it would take a lot of change, and it would take a good few years for guys to see out the terms of their central deals. But maybe down the line it could be tweaked, so it's, because it is a massive advantage for Leinster, and they deserve a lot of that, because as I say, they're producing players. But it is giving them scope for the rich to become richer, I guess is how you could put it.
And Leinster have always had an advantage there, James, in terms of population to begin with, because they have twice the population, more than twice the population of Munster, something like 5 times the population of Connacht. I think it's around 3 times the population of Ulster. But what they've done in the professional era, and particularly over the last 12, 13 years, is actually put the structures in place to harvest that talent, to cultivate that talent, to polish it off, put it on the big stage. They're better at that than virtually any other team in the world. So there's a duality to it, in that you have a natural advantage, but also professionally, you are exceptional at what you do, and better than the other provinces at doing it as well, regardless of the number of players coming through. But I'm curious as to what you make of it. You obviously played for Leinster. You're a Leinster man. Can you understand or empathise with fans of the other provinces who don't view this system as being correct at the moment? Or would you look at, say, the national team and the points that Murray is making and kind of say, like, it is working. It's up to the other provinces to pull their socks up, do better in terms of generating talent that allows them to earn central contracts that they can take off their wage bill and build from there?
There's multiple ways to look at it, but every single solution has a pitfall. So the current system's pitfall, where it obviously rewards building your own players and nurturing, but with the clear advantage, as you just said, of population size and the ability to have schools and clubs that are like mini academies feeding into the province. It's kind of snowballed to this point where, you know, people are questioning whether these lads should be on a central contract. And you're kind of like, you know, what are we at here? They're the best player in their position. Of course, they're going to get a central contract. So you work back from that and you're like, okay, well, if we want to make it fair, are we willing to settle that we'll never win a European Cup again with an Irish province and have a draft system where, every, say, 20 or 21-year-old is pooled every year and the worst province gets first pick, you know, and so on and so forth. And we spread the wealth throughout the country, and we do it the kind of American way. And you know, our national side shouldn't be affected too badly because we still have the same pool of players playing in the country, but we're not going to be able to compete with the French sides who are able to pick World 15 type teams. And we're not going to have, you know, again, there'll be a big focus on getting in NIQ players to strengthen up each side, and you're kind of back into this vicious cycle of spreading the wealth, but at the same time there's going to be pitfalls to it. So I think it'd be an interesting thing to have a draft or some sort of draft system, but do I blame Leinster or the players who are currently on central contracts? I think everyone who's on a central contract deserves to be on one. As you said, the only one who isn't, who deserves to be at only two, are Mac and Gibson Park. I think everyone else is like, on paper, I don't understand how you could argue against it. Is it fair if you're from another province? It's tough to take. It's never easy to look at another province doing well, so well, and seem to be pulling further and further away. But it all starts with producing players and the quality of the coaching and making good decisions on your NIQ players, because I think that's a glaring issue or elephant in the room of the amount of money wasted by some of the provinces on NIQ players that have completely flopped. Versus, I think you do well to name more than three NIQ Leinster players in the last maybe 8 years that are flops. So there's an element of that as well. I think that a little bit of responsibility needs to be taken for some of the recruitment of the NIQ players, as well as the grassroots and feeding into that side of the game. But the reality is the grassroots side of things will never be even because of the population. So there has to be some sort of allowance given there. But again, it comes down to recruitment of your NIQs and getting them right, because if you're throwing crazy money at average players and they flop, like what do you expect? And you're giving out, then you're not able to compete. But like, you're wasting money on players, and of course there's injuries and different things. But you know, Ulster of old, when they were at their best, had top quality NIQ players. You know, bringing in, you know, one big marquee signing isn't going to be enough when the foundations of the club were clearly in not a good place. And I feel like the other provinces as well, like the signings they make, I don't think they need to go for your World Cup finalists. I think, you know, you can find very, very, very good players that are underappreciated in terms of international ability or accolades, that can slot in and do a serious job for you. Look at Issa Nasewa or players like that. You know, obviously, James Lowe was another one where, you know, he was never going to be, or it wasn't even in the conversation for an All Black, and that's why he moved over here, but has worked out so well. Same with Gibson Park. Whoever's making these decisions, like that they're just getting them right more than often. And I feel like that's something the other provinces need to get right more, as those NIQs. But I do agree and feel for them in terms of the player pool thing. I just don't have an answer for it without it being some sort of draft, maybe.
Just like the other provinces would make the point that they are starting to get their houses in order as well. They are starting to nurture more talent. James makes an excellent point, I think, about their recruitment of NIQ players. Munster would point towards Alex Nankivell as a really good example of exactly what he's talking about. Somebody who might have been on the fringes of All Black contention has come over and is starting to do a really good job for them. But equally, because of the population thing, because of Dublin being the economic hub of the country, and because of how that has bled through society to create this Leinster school system, which is to a degree a stroke of good fortune for Leinster, as much as they've helped it along the way as well. The other provinces can't really try to replicate that model. It's just not possible, actually. So they have to find their own ways. And like, they're working on it, is my point, right? Like, there are surely other avenues for them, the club system, etc., to just start producing more players, better players. And narrow the gap in a different way to having to rely on finances that are unattainable to them at the moment.
And I think you're right. That is happening. Like Munster is a good example there. They're current URC champions, and we should remember that. They've had a great renewal in the last couple of years. And for me, the talent coming through now is excellent. I think there's a couple of guys there. Jack Crowley, the most obvious one. I think you did mention him earlier on, Gav, who if he continues on this trajectory, is going to be on a central contract sooner rather than later. I think he's 2025 for his contract. If he's Ireland's leading out half still at the next negotiation and clearly is going to be for the next 10 years, well, he's either going to go on a central contract straight away or that'll be part of the negotiation. I think there's a couple other guys there who have the potential maybe to do that as well. And if Munster were really honest, they'd probably say that there's a couple of years missing there where the pipeline didn't really deliver players through, and that absence is being felt now, that there's not a Conor Murray or a Peter O'Mahony stepping into that breach and should be on a central contract. Crowley's probably the next one and a couple to follow him. Connacht, it's always going to be so difficult to develop players to that level. Robbie Henshaw, they deserve the credit there for him producing a player like him, and I know he moved to Leinster, but they should have the pride in delivering a guy like that, and Ulster with Ian Henderson. And you would hope that some of the prospects there are going to step up to that level, but they're not going to produce players in the same quantity, I don't think, in terms of at that central contracting level. And the last time we discussed this, Gav, the central contract thing, I kind of finished our chat by saying it is a bit weird, isn't it? And the label almost is the weird part of it, and that probably leads to the sense of injustice. And maybe that's how the RFU could do it a little bit more smartly, that it's a little bit more, not that you want to hide these things, but a little bit more invisible, and you know, the provincial contracts are topped up to a greater extent. Now, the same imbalance still exists there because the RFU are giving that budget, that extra cash to the province to keep a player who otherwise might be lured abroad. But maybe just not announcing it as central contracts all the time would make people feel less aggrieved. And that's the other thing, like this, these high-value IRFU contracts have made it a complete non-discussion, really, for guys even really looking around the world now or thinking about moving. And it's never been a massive thing in Irish rugby. We're a lot of home birds, I think, and people love playing their rugby here and love staying where they are. But those high-value contracts are an important part of it, and it also allows them to incredibly manage those players incredibly well in terms of the physical side of the game. And that's something that those high profile players regularly mention, that they feel they're taken care of better here than anywhere. So they're the positive sides of it, but I think I'll be curious to see how this develops or morphs in the coming years. And yet I wouldn't give up hope that there's not other guys around the country, definitely not in the numbers of Leinster, but other guys who in the coming 4 or 5 years can push that level. And someone like Crowley he's the perfect example. Like, we always talk about cohesion in the Ireland team. Like, your number 10 is probably the most important guy for cohesion. He needs to understand everyone around him. And yet, it's not a Leinster out half who's taken over from Johnny Sexton. It's Jack Crowley, because he's, in my opinion, the most talented of the bunch. And that's the level that other players around the country probably need to aspire to pushing towards. And I know he can get better himself, but it shows that, you know, all hope is not lost.
James, what did you make of the hiring of Tyler Blaendahl, a guy with whom we're all familiar, certainly Munster fans, I would say, still think fondly of him despite him taking this opportunity? It makes a lot of sense for him and his family, undoubtedly. And I guess the most pertinent thing to my mind right now is Hurricanes are top of the Super Rugby table. They're playing some really lovely rugby with a bit of an understated squad, actually. So what do you make of this recruitment and how you feel he might fit into Leinster's system next season?
Yeah, I think out of what is out there, for getting the like for like in for Goodman, it's a great coup. And chatting to a few of the Munster lads who would have played with him for a bit, say, like a gent of a fella. So excited about that part and what he's going to bring. Again, you're getting that current perspective of how they look at the game over in Super Rugby, and Goodman brought that with the kind of Crusaders look, and now we're going to get to see the Hurricanes kind of look on how they view the game and how they attack and different drills they do and how they bring their teams of the week and different pick teams apart. So always good to get a fresh perspective. We've seen that with Enan Barr, so I'm excited to see what he's going to bring. But even much of the same of what Goodman has been bringing to Leinster would be good enough.
It is interesting that they're going with another Kiwi, I guess, Murray. It might be purely incidental, but I guess when you look at it on the face of it, having Jack Nienaber in charge of your defence, something which we would typically associate with South African rugby anyway, and he just happens to be one of the greatest coaches of all time at really honing in on that area of the game, and then bringing over, firstly, the little bit of Kiwi flair in Goodman, and now Blaendahl, when we've seen the Hurricanes kind of hum so nicely in Super Rugby, it does feel like a really good, like a really strong coaching ticket. But one as well, which, as James outlined there, is bringing like different methodologies, different ideas on the game, similar to how Jordy Barrett might train. It's just like you're creating this fountain of knowledge from which the players can really thrive.
And that seems to be the big thinking for Leo and the overall kind of Leinster hierarchy, that they have very different viewpoints within the coaching team, and it feels a very like-for-like successor. Blaendahl, I remember when he was in Munster, all the players, because he was injured a lot, saying just how influential he was behind the scenes tactically, that he had this amazing brain, that he was akin to a coach in those spells when he couldn't play, which unfortunately was quite a lot, and they were very certain that he'd become a really good coach, and the signs in the Hurricanes are good. Like, it's still early enough in his coaching career, he's a young man and already making a good influence. I've watched all their games this season, they've been playing brilliant rugby, they have some incredibly explosive athletes of course, but they have vastly improved a couple of guys who are kind of in their mid-20s who looked like kind of squad players and now look like world beaters at the moment. They're scoring lots of tries, they're making lots of line breaks, they look innovative, they counter-attack really well, and when they strike off set piece, they're really slick, really sick, and that'll be a massive part of his role as well. So yeah, I think Leinster will be pretty pleased with this appointment, and it kind of continues the team of having guys from different areas of the world. And it also, the bit I kind of wanted to kind of make the point on, I know we're going to come to the game now, the performance against La Rochelle was this beautiful blend of the new defensive grit and all the Nienaber traits, but also the attacking side of it was outstanding. Like, it was pure Leinster, it was pure Goodman as well, and his philosophy is, I guess, similar to the classic Leinster way of playing, and it was the perfect blend. That in all the performances this season, it's kind of been weighted, I suppose, towards us looking at the defence, because it's been so interesting to see what Nienaber has been doing. And even they've said that, you know, they put a lot of focus on that, of course, in training defensively, but they got back to a lovely balance point between the two, and a blend of the two, rather, is a better way of describing it.
And that's why I'm delighted to have James on as well, because on Monday when we were looking at it, we certainly begun talking about the game through the prism of defence and how that was almost a determining factor and allowed them to do everything else. But like, James, I know you were making the point even before the game, offloads out of the tackle, areas like this were going to be absolutely key to Leinster beating this La Rochelle team. And in the end, it was about as complete an attacking performance as you could possibly hope for against a team of La Rochelle's calibre, right? Like, this was the Leinster, it's a different sport now, but it was almost like the Leinster we would have grown up watching in a way.
Yeah. The first two lineouts of the game now wouldn't have filled any Leinster supporters with confidence. Ulton Delan getting up and stealing off a four-man lineout to the very front of the line, on the 5 meter line, and then second lineout, Osborne goes a little bit early. He's definitely the intended carrier. By the time Gibson Park has the ball in his hands off the lineout to throw it, he's already standing flat with Kerr Barlow standing opposite him. It kind of spooks Gibson Park, throws it over the top of them as a reaction, and you're kind of thinking, oh my God, you know, like, we're at two early chances to apply some pressure, and we've messed them up. But an interesting theme which followed was You know, off that Frawley gets a poach on the edge. You know, I played with Frawley for I don't know how many years. I don't think I've ever seen him get a poach. Then, you know, it kills it anyway. It goes to a scrum, and then you know we fast forward about 7-8 minutes, and La Rochelle are counter attacking after some great mall defense. Which we'll get on to actually in a little bit, because I feel like that was another thing that won Leinster the game. Joe McCarthy comes up with a big steal and Leinster clear, but some lovely counter attack by Lade, and he offloads Carvalho, and Jordan Larmour comes up with a poach. And I'm just sitting there thinking, with like, again, I couldn't count on one hand the amount of times I've seen Jordan come up with a poach in the time that I played with him. And you know that they go on to score James Lowe's try from this series of attacking kicks that follow. You kick up the line, they put James Lowe puts the ball in behind, it goes into the end ball or into the try zone, and they put it down for a goal line dropout. Leinster counter attack off the goal line dropout. They have another attacking kick from Jamie Osborne. James Lowe recovers and they get into their beautiful Leinster flow that you were talking about, that we're used to seeing over the years. And we saw some pops out of the tackle from Joe McCarthy and the obvious one from Ross Byrne at the end that I saw the Stormers do, that it just seems to, if you let La Rochelle have one point of contact and get their poachers on the ball, you just can't play against them because they're so effective at slowing you down. You have, you know, like you've Bhatia, I know Bugarit wasn't playing, but when he is playing, so effective at getting on the ball. You've Dante in the centre, so effective at getting on the ball. And you've Skelton who just comes in and makes an absolute mess of every ruck and you know lies on top of people and they're 10 seconds out of the game. Leinster just didn't allow them, like past games, to have a single point of contact to be able to get as many perches on the ball as they have before. But I just love the addition of clearly the backs, as well as having that license to fly and try to get man and ball in defence, whether they miss them or not. They also are clearly been told to get your head over the ball and try poaching. They're clearly practicing it because we're seeing them now come up with poaches. Gibson Park as well had a really big moment in the second half where he comes up with a poach. Again, could count on one hand the amount of times I've seen him stick his head in a ruck in my time playing. So something has changed in their DNA that they're clearly having a more aggressive mindset from everyone in terms of putting pressure on the ball. We see the obvious stuff like the counter rucking, the making sure the ruck, all that is brilliant. But I'm just find it so interesting seeing guys that wouldn't necessarily have ever tried a poach before coming up with huge moments in big games. And it's clearly something that they're practicing and they're talking about, as well as those attacking kicks off second receiver, the Henshaw try, or sorry, the Henshaw one to Lowe, the Osborne one for the Lowe first try. There was multiple throughout the game. Again, just turning La Rochelle, constantly turning La Rochelle, and you have to do that against these big sides. But it's exciting to see them grow and kind of change. Tiny little minute details that makes a big difference on the big stage.
What did you see in Leinster's Mall defence, James, that impressed you, aside from the outcome, obviously?
So their plan was what impressed me. So rule number one against a big, good Mall is do not let them win the ball behind you, because if they win the ball behind you and you go up in the air to contest, you have less than zero of a chance of stopping them. And we saw that in the red 43 and almost 44 minutes. They do a line out over the 15, and Jenkins is defending on the 15, almost gets it. He's a fingertip away from getting it. But if you sense that they're going over the 15, you've got to be sure you're going to get the ball, because if you don't get it, it's nearly a certain try. Or if you bite forward and they win it behind you, stay on the ground and deal with it. It's an instinct moment. He was a centimeter from making the right call and getting it. But anyway, you're against a world-class line out with a world-class Mall. And that's what happens when you get it wrong. Apart from that one Maul D set, they dealt really, really well. Now there was a couple of penalties that led up to that one again where they got beaten in behind. But it was the first Maul of the game, the Joe McCarthy turnover that leads to, as I said, the two attacking kicks and the James Hall try. They gave them the front, let them win it in front, and they shut off the back corner, is what you call the open side of the field, to where the Maul wants to go away from the touchline. And they allowed La Rochelle kind of tried to shear down the blind side, which gives access to the ball when the ball's passing. If you're part of the Maul and all of a sudden the ball is passing you, you know, you can kind of just make your way there to the ball. And that's exactly what Joe McCarthy did, and comes up with a lovely steal. We saw them do that multiple times throughout the game. The another really obvious one was in, it was maybe the mid 30 minutes. We had the moment, and again ends up leading to a score where Ryan Baird, so you see Skelton coming around the front, clearly trying to block Furlong in on what they're trying to do. Was Aldry was trying to go up the five with the hooker. Ryan Baird's obviously done his homework on when they come down in a certain way with a double bank on either side of the jumper, that he's going to try to get his hand through and get on the ball. Tyke Furlong's job at the front there is to not get locked in and don't engage in the ball. If you see that someone coming around, if someone's on your outside shoulder and you're at the front of the line out, it's bad news. I know from defending there many a time, rule number one is do not hit that Maul. Get your head on the outside. So you see him actually disengage and not hit it out of instinct, ready for anything that might be coming. But Ryan Baird's actually done a good enough job to disrupt the ball. It bounces up off of Aldered and then back into Ryan Baird's hands. Moments like that, it's not by accident. It's the detail and the plan of what they've gone in and how they've managed to look at such a weapon for La Rochelle and come up with a way of dealing with it to the best of their ability. Never going to be perfect. You're never going to get it right all the time. You can't defend every option, but you pick a few. Another one which I thought was a great reaction, and this was the start of the second half. La Rochelle are doing a 5+1 with what Aldered. The plan is to break out like we see with Ireland loads, where the dummy Maul and break out. Jenkins is the third last man in. You've Sheehan and you have Porter, and then Jenkins' instinct there is to hit the edge of that Maul, and you hear Porter recognizes the picture and he calls him out, and Jenkins does a really good reaction job of not hitting it, making the chop on Aldered. They get a double poach and they kick to the corner, and eventually Baird comes up with a score off of multiple phases. But really pleasing. I love that part of the game, the analysis into plan, into action, and the knock on result of it. And it was very satisfying to watch, knowing that there was a lot of work that went on behind the scenes to allow those moments to happen, as well as the reactions in the moment.
Murray, I know you've had a rewatch since we spoke about it on Monday. Was there anything that caught your eye the second time around that maybe you hadn't picked up the first time around?
The team was so much of what James just pointed out, like how well coached this was, how well tailored it was. And I love when really good teams do that. And listen, I love when teams completely back themselves and think, we'll just do what we do and beat everyone. But I love to see the plan that they put in place and how they have slight tweaks to their usual approach. The attacking kicks off the second or even third set of hands, as it was Osborne that time. Like, they go through Byrne. There's even a sweep out the back, isn't there? And Henshaw then hits Osborne. And at that stage, La Rochelle are obviously presuming this is a run attack, and he kicks and Lowe, in fairness, does a brilliant job to win the scraps there. But it just felt like they were teasing their way around the pitch in that manner. And also what stood out the second time around was the epic nature of some of the defensive sets, because I think I always wanted the trap of over focusing on the try scoring passages and enjoying them the most, but there were some phenomenal passages leading up to some of the turnovers you mentioned. Even the Gibson Park one, the set just before that was so abrasive and so even while lads are being back to go and take ball and all and stop the ball, still connected to each other and still working in twos and threes. As you saw for that turnover, I think it's Baird who chops and it's Sheehan who anchors Gibson Park into place, and his technique is beautiful over the ball. And that sense of hunting in little packs was really apparent. Even towards the end of the game when it's completely decided, you could see the glee that Leinster were taking in defending. That set where it leads up to Caelan Dyer's having his kind of John Smith Avitt moment where he just leathers the ball on the ground upfield. The pressure that led to that loose ball was phenomenal, and La Rochelle just couldn't withstand it. And even the chase on the end of it was so energetic. The Joe McCarty turnover right at the end on Maldi as well. Like the fact that they were still putting all that stuff that James has mentioned into place there, and you could see how much satisfaction that McCarty in particular gleaned from it. I thought there was a dig thrown in there. I was watching it back again last night, and Ronan Keller certainly did as well. But it just highlighted the frustration of La Rochelle at just having none of those usual ins to the game. They probably thought the Maul try just before half time was that one, but then Leinster makes such a perfect start really to the second half that that's just kind of scratched from the record almost. So it was very complete performance in all aspects. They kicked well, they exited well, they attacked with real accuracy with ball in hand, and then the defensive performance was pretty awesome really.
One of my favourite elements of that little skirmish at the end involving McCarthy and others is that James Lowe is standing at safe remove from it, and as it's kicking off, he's bouncing up and down on each leg, fist pumping the air, just getting the crowd going. And that was one of my favourite elements of Leinster's performance, actually, was when they even had the game won, James, they rubbed La Rochelle's noses in it, as you should to a team who have had a bit of a psychological edge on you and have played these mind games, shared these mind games with you over the last couple of years. Make it hurt. Lock the gates, make them watch. And Leinster certainly did that. And I'm wondering, as someone who was quite forgiving, or at least understanding, as you were, of those two final defeats, at least in recent years, because the margins were so thin, I recall you not feeling it was this generational disaster the way it felt to some people in the in the Inquisition afterwards. As somebody as well who was contact with players, like, was this as cathartic for them as it felt at the stadium or watching on TV? Like, did it have an extra significance that they were kind of banishing demons to some extent?
I don't think banishing demons, but like, even though there was a big, it was a big scoreline, and you know, we spanked them, which is, I don't think anyone can argue. I think these teams play each other 10 times. I think each team wins 5 times. Like that, there is not much between them, and I think they could, on their day, put a score, like a decent score up as well. And that's the beauty of it. But from the point of view of, you know, you're talking about James Lowe and hopping up and down and the satisfaction, these lads hate each other. And like there's a lot of bad blood, which is rooted in respect, but they really, really don't like each other. And that there's a lot of elements that play into that. It's the on-field and the off-field stuff. It's the pain that they've caused. It's, you put yourself in La Rochelle's, this team who think they're great because they want, you know, they've won European Cups before, and, you know, they've been knocking around it for a while. They think they're tough. They think they're whatever. Because I remember, you know, when they beat us first over there, that was kind of their team. And like, I thought you'd be a bit tougher kind of thing. And that kind of sparked it. Bit of disrespect to us, been like, Jesus, like, you know, you're not going to say it in the European Cup, like, don't stick the knife in. And they continue to stick the knife in for the next couple of years, both on and off pitch. So I'm okay with that. I like a rivalry. But, you know, don't be crying when you're on the other side of it, because we've been the ones who've had to suck it up for the last couple of years. So it's your turn to suck it up and take the pain of losing on the big stage. But was it satisfying? Yes. Did I love every second of it? Yes, I did. And so did the players, because they genuinely really, really do not like this team. But my God, is the level of respect is top notch. But it's just, it's a grudge match. And listen, what would we be doing if we didn't have teams that love to beat each other playing in the biggest stage? It's what you want. It's what you play support for. It's what we watch support for. So rivalries are great. Long may they last. But this is officially a big European rivalry. They've both beaten each other a few times now. We can call it that. But from Leinster point of view, the only dampener is it means nothing really until we get it done and win a European Cup. You know, like, they might have won the battle, but you don't win the war unless you're able to put an extra star on that jersey. And there's still unfinished business in terms of this year. But my God, was that weekend satisfying.
One of the other satisfying things, Gavs, is that Leinster players really showed their kind of game smarts, and their game sense is really acutely tuned. Even if you think of the low try where Henshaw has that beautiful kick into space, and it's a great finish from low to kind of reel the ball in with Jack Noel right on top of him. But that comes from a regained box kick where Gibson Park hangs it up on the right-hand side, and Larmour does a brilliant job of winning it back. And often your instinct when you have that initial turnover or regain of the kick is, let's just pass it to Whyth. But it's actually a great time to kick, because obviously the backfield is really going to have to be struggling to reorganize itself, because they've been drawn in by that initial kick and have had to deal with that. And it was really calmly done by Leinster to execute that. And even little moments. Do you remember when Van der Fleer, he sees that Uribe is on, yeah, he's on the ground. And he's a player on the ground, can't make a tackle, and Van der Fleer sees him and he just beelines for him. And his acceleration is scary. I was thinking, I would not like to be a Rebrand on the ground. And he plows into him, and it's a penalty. Josh Van der Fleer is fairly appealing for a yellow card there, because otherwise it's a big line break and they're true. But they stick with the penalty. I just thought it showed that even with all the, even with that kind of wild edge that they brought defensively, there was still the smarts and the understanding of looking at things and thinking your way through it on the pitch. I did want to ask you though, James, because even I thought that was reflecting the scrum. I thought Tadhg Furlong did a really good job on Penverran, who was obviously inexperienced. He was really getting in his head by, it seemed to me, just kept nudging his head and unsettling him right before the bind. I don't know what you saw in that area, because I know they had one big loss, didn't they, at one stage, but they had one absolutely gigantic scrum pen on halfway. How did you see that battle?
I thought the scrum was really good. It was always going to be a big part of the game. I think they carried over the momentum that they had in Six Nations into this. They're still coming off a split stance with the second rows, which I think it's an interesting one. A lot of teams come off two knees. So the second rows, instead of being in a kind of sprinter stance, they'll start on two knees and come up. The benefit is there's no feet moving. You know, there's less movement. Your weight is directly, like, it never leaves the arses of the front row, and the pressure coming through is solid. But you don't get the same kind of punch that you do when you're coming off of that kind of sprinter stance. It's quite effective for them, but against the bigger teams, I always just worry a little bit. And I thought they managed it quite well, but a couple of times lost balance. I thought Furlong fought really well. Like you mentioned, you call that the headspace. As a loose head, you're trying to take away the headspace, because you want to get under the chest of a tight head. And as a tight head, you want to keep the loose head on the outside. And as an inexperienced loose head, you can get rattled by that kind of head battle and dealing with that. But I think Furlong's scrummaging is in the last this season is probably the best that it's ever been, and his ability to deal with the different pictures he's facing every week. But he's in terms of top trumps of scrummaging, he's the most intelligent scrummager I've ever wrapped my arm around anyway, and his understanding of how to deal with different threats and what he's feeling in there and everything, and what he demands from his hooker in his second row and everything like that. He's a great thinker as well as a doer in terms of scrummaging. But he did a great job of keeping him on the outside. And as you mentioned, Murray, that penalty in the second half was a big momentum kind of final nail in the coffin for Leinster. And you know, taking away, you know, you take away their maul, you take away their big carriers, and finally you take away their scrum. And just from a psychological point of view, it was a big win that moment. Now, saying all this, as I said, it's going to be great fuel when these teams meet again of how they deal with all the different threats inside the things. But it's we're going to enjoy the weekend and relish in winning those moments and big scrum penalties.
I'm glad you've said that again, because that was, Gav, you asked what I kind of gleaned from getting another detailed watch of it. I have to say, La Rochelle were, and we've highlighted all the Leinster excellence, and we should do it, and that is really relevant, and they limited what La Rochelle did. But La Rochelle will feel they were well off it. They'll feel that. I think one of the things you flagged before, James, was that loads of Leinster guys had to have massive individual performances. I don't think La Rochelle really got that. And yes, it was because they were shut down to a brilliant degree. Like, Skelton just couldn't get a roll on, and they did a brilliant job defensively on him. But a lot of their players weren't at the level they have been at. And collectively, that was true as well. And yeah, I don't think this just finishes the rivalry anyway, because it's a big win. Maybe because La Rochelle are... their age profile is a bit, they're just a bit older, some of their key guys. But I thought they definitely struggled after the travel and all that, and coming to Cork, obviously didn't get all the fatigue out of their legs. But they've been up and down this season, and this was definitely one of their downs. So while loads of Leinster brilliance made this a completely deserved win, and I don't mean to take from that, I think La Rochelle would be really gutted that they weren't... they weren't at their peak individually, collectively.
Just on Furlong briefly, James, he's back in a big way, isn't he? I felt it even during the Six Nations and now for Leinster, and his role is slightly different, like the kind of eye-catching type Furlong to a more casual observer who is the huge man who was used constantly as a link player and showed those beautiful hands, and there's still that element in his game for sure. We saw it against La Rochelle, but it's his work at the breakdown is ferocious. Like, he's really important to Leinster and Ireland in that area of the game. Like, I don't think he ever went away, to be clear, but even outside of his scrummaging, is he kind of in top form or close enough to it to you?
He's back to his best. And listen, I think we can all empathise with someone who's gone through a tough time off the field, and that's what he was for a couple of years. So that clearly took its toll in terms of his on-field play. But you know, he's found that fire in him again that we saw when he burst onto the scene and did for so many years, and I'm just delighted for him that he's back to his best, both, as you said, around the field with his little touches, his ability to take the ball to the line square and pull it out the back, his ability to like clear bulldoze rooks and take men off their feet, and then also to deal with the likes of Skelton and get back up and make a big hit and ultimately to land 2 seconds later. You know, we don't have that many huge men that are Irish, so you need the big guys to step up and front up against those giants. And you know, he's a leader in that group, and I know that he would have been driving it all week. It's scrum time, it's going to be like very big. What was the plan going to be? He's going to be driving that side of things, telling people what he's going to expect from them in different areas, but also around the field. You know, been like, I'm going to show up, I'm going to, you know, deal with this guy, he's coming down my channel, I want everyone to come with me. And that's what you want as a player, is to be in the trenches with someone who's humming like he is at the moment. And it gives you such comfort and confidence going into games when you see the amount of prep and video and stuff in the gym that Tadhg does. It doesn't just happen on the weekend. Like, he's an ultimate professional, and everything that happens isn't by accident.
He's such a great leader now in all those aspects you mentioned, even the behind the scenes stuff. That's great insight, because that's struck me as how more comfortable he's become with all that. And I remember they first put him in the Ireland leadership group and he was kind of baffled at it. He was thinking, I have to start thinking about the game on a bigger level now. But he's grown into that. And that was an aspect of the game that was really good for Leinster, I thought, as well. Like, obviously, Johnny Sexton's no longer there. They're missing their two co-captains in Gary Ringrose and James Ryan. Hugo Keenan is a very much a leader by example and pure assurance at the back. But they were really good on that front. I did mention it briefly on Monday, but I thought Caelan Dyers was class in terms of especially the ref stuff, which he admitted the first time he captained Leinster in the Ulster game that he actually got a couple of things wrong. He went to the ref and he tried to make a case, but when he reviewed the game, he realised his case was weak because he actually was in the wrong. This time, I thought he nailed it every time he went. He had a really clear, concise point. There seemed to be a very good respect there, and Dixon was definitely listening to him and even kind of seeking him out a couple of times to explain things to him. So that was really positive to see, because that's obviously a big chat around Irish rugby in general for the next few years and where that's going. And Dyers, as well as his excellent performance, where he brought just total menace and great skill. I didn't realise he wasn't wearing a boot for the first slow try where he makes the pass to Ross Byrne. He lost his boot a long time before that. Will Skelton absolutely launches into the stand, which is so Will Skelton. And it was great watching Will Skelton's off the ball stuff as always. But yeah, Dyers still had the guile and he has a few involvements indeed without a boot. And I thought him, in terms of his individual performance, which is so key for a leader, for a skipper, but also how he did the ref chat was brilliant.
Yeah, he's definitely grown. He's grown into that role, and it probably takes some time in the saddle for him to be more comfortable. But he's a very emotionally intelligent guy, so I've no doubt he'll keep growing from that point of view. But I think it's actually interesting that if he becomes, say, Leinster and Ireland captain, I think it's actually a good thing in the short term for Munster in terms of the development of Ahern. I feel like you can't really look past O'Mahony at the moment, Ireland captain for Munster. I just feel Ahern's best position is six, and he needs game time there. Now, they use him in general play at six. They have him standing kind of out wide and doing different roles in phase plays. But I feel like if he's to play for Ireland, it's going to be at six. I don't think he's going to get enough time this season there. Time will tell, maybe next season. But I think there's actually a funny knock-on effect if Dyers is to start captain and Leinster, what happens next year in terms of that Ireland captaincy and the potential knock-on effect by that. Now, I want to caveat that by saying that I think Pete is a phenomenal captain and worthy of the starting jersey for now. But I'm just saying, looking forward, I think I'm so excited by the prospect of how good Ahern could be. But it's as a six, in my opinion.
Moving to six, give him a central contract straight away.
Exactly.
That's all the problems. Gav, I just got an email notification there and I clicked in. It's Owen has emailed us, Owen Clocker or Cloaker. A fairly short question in comparison to most you get. Given the last few weeks and the overall new Sephora era, why would I bother to continue to support Connacht in Ireland? Cheers. So there is definitely some despondency out there. Sorry to bring it all back to the start of the chat. I feel for you, Owen. I do feel for you, Owen.
And I do think the IRFU just need to be careful with that specifically. Don't force fans to disengage. Don't become the baddies in this situation. And certainly fans of the other three provinces would consider Leinster that for the moment anyway. But I think Leinster are embracing that as well, by the way. The timing of these announcements is absolutely hilarious by them to follow up Sheehan's central contract on the same day with a Geordie Barrett signing that nobody was expecting. That's them going, like, fuck the rest of us, you know? And they should do that. They should do that. It's the other provinces aren't their concern. But from the IRFU's perspective, just be careful, you know? Just be careful that people don't go exactly as Owen has outlined there. Like, F this, really. We could go on all day, but we actually cannot. So I've got to say thanks and farewell. James, absolutely brilliant to have you on. Great to see you again. Thanks a million.
Thanks for having me.
Murray, same to you. Great to see you. Thanks a lot.
Cheers. Enjoyed it, lads.
Thanks everyone at home as well for all of your continued support. Thank you to our producer, Sean. And we will be back later in the week. We didn't have time to preview the URC games. We'll do so when teams are named on Friday. So catch you then. Mind yourselves in the meantime. Take care.
Put the boys in a better land. You're always talking about the boys in a better land. The boys in a better land. Drivers got names for 50 double barrels.